Case number 19-6235, Keisha Turner et al. Versus Deborah Lowen et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes by the plaintiffs and 15 minutes to be shared by the defendants. Ms. Connie Reguli, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Connie Reguli from the Tennessee Bar. We are here today on a civil rights case involving the rights of two very small children, their 4th and 14th Amendment rights. The defendants in this case are Ms. Duncan and Ms. Scott, who are both employees of the Department of Children's Services, whom I'll refer to as DCS, and Dr. Deborah Lowen, who is a doctor at Vanderbilt Medical Center, as well as Vanderbilt was named as a defendant. And first, I want to talk about Duncan and Scott. The district court dismissed on a Rule 12 on Duncan and Scott on absolute immunity and qualified immunity. This is a case, and these issues with child protective services and the actions that they take in the removal of children from their home has been something that has, I'm just going to say, kind of appears to have bounced around a little bit in the Sixth Circuit. However, those cases haven't truly nuanced out the difference of what a social worker does when they remove a child versus when they act as a prosecutor. And that's been something in different cases that has not really been distinguished until the Brank case. And as I put in my opening about the oral arguments, we had the Young v. Vega case in 2014, which was not recommended for publication. But then following that was Barber v. Miller, also not recommended for publication. And finally, we get up to 2018, which is the Brent case. And in the Brent case, the court did now begin, did nuance out whether or not a social worker was acting, basically preparing an affidavit that would trigger a court hearing versus a social worker taking an action to remove a child, particularly ex parte. The district court said that because the Brent case was in 2018, that in 2014, when these events occurred, that it was not clearly established. I would like for this court to consider that as early as 2012 in Andrews v. Hickman County, which was a case that I was honored to bring to the Sixth Circuit, is where we addressed whether or not the Fourth Amendment applied to social workers. And I talk about that in my brief, starting in about page 34, that in Andrews v. Hickman County, it specifically acknowledged that neither the Sixth Circuit nor the Supreme Court had explicitly held that the Fourth Amendment permitted a social worker exception. Now, in the Andrews case, indeed, it was not a removal, but it was an unlawful entry into a home. But the court said that social workers could not assume that in the absence of a decision explicitly confirming that the Fourth Amendment applies to social workers, they were not free to ignore the basic Fourth Amendment principles that are clearly articulated and embedded in our constitutional jurisprudence. And that's, Your Honors, what I would submit that this case is about. As I go on in my brief from about pages 36 to 40, I articulate and describe several cases in the Sixth Circuit and United States Supreme Court about how false evidence or omitted evidence cannot be used to initiate an arrest. In this case, we're talking about two children, two very, very young children. The first child, RBT, was born in 2014. And his parents were compelled to take him to Vanderbilt University, where he was examined by Dr. Lowen, who is under the specialty of child abuse pediatrician. Dr. Lowen then diagnosed the child with child abuse, and it was solely upon that which DCS removed that child. And within just a few months later, in 2015, when the mother had her second child, when the child was only 4 days old, DCS used that same information and took and removed CT from his home without ever any findings of any other actions or concerns by the parents. The Department of Children's Services and Deborah Lowen knew that there were other issues other complex medical issues, particularly metabolic bone disease, that could have manifested as in the fractured ribs that were found in RBT when he was taken to Vanderbilt Hospital in 2014. So we submit that they withheld information that would negate probable cause. They falsified information when they said that the only cause could be child abuse. So we're asking for a reversal, and that it was not, Duncan and Scott should not be granted absolute immunity because they were acting in their investigative capacity. In fact, Tanya Scott, who was one of the defendants, admitted that the Department of Children's Services was under this continuing duty of investigation throughout the entire proceeding of the case. Next, I would like to move on to Lowen. In Lowen, the court found that she would be entitled to qualified immunity under Filarski. And I would submit to your honors that this is a de novo review. It is a question of law, and that this is more in line with the Richardson case. And it is a case where, excuse me one moment, clearly the defendant is working for a private firm. She had limited direct supervision by the government. She was undertaking a task for profit, and there's potential competition with other firms. And those are the tests for Richardson's that would show that a private person would not even be entitled to qualified immunity. However, should this court find that the Filarski is more in line with the role taken by Lowen, that they should deny her qualified immunity and that she acted in concert with these state actors. I would also like to then...
Did you make your in concert argument below?
I'm sorry, sir?
Did you make your acting in concert argument below? Was that your theory of recovery below?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, it was. And finally, I want to speak just a moment about Vanderbilt University in particular. So Vanderbilt University Medical Center is the employer of Dr. Lowen. I point out in my brief, or in the complaint and in the brief, we claim there that custom policy practice were sufficient to state a claim. In our, when we talk about Vanderbilt, we talk about the use of care teams, which are held without notice to the parents to discuss the medical conditions of the children to decide whether or not, or to create a legal presumption of child abuse. Also, that there is a practice of ignoring feasible medical explanations for injuries, and that was the moving force for the constitutional violations of the concealment of exculpatory evidence. Dr. Lowen is a person with advanced knowledge. She works in an area that is classified as a child abuse pediatrician. Therefore, we submit that with this advanced knowledge, she investigated the case, she separated the parents, she put them in separate rooms to talk to them, and then she made a diagnosis of child abuse. Now, it's very important to distinguish here that Dr. Lowen was not a treating physician, and she was not a physician that made a report of harm, because if she were in any one of those two positions, then she perhaps would have had immunity, perhaps some state immunity, as being a doctor who reported harm, but she is not. Dr. Lowen is the doctor that the Department of Children's Services ordered these parents to go to. Instead of taking the child back to their primary care hospital, which would have been East Tennessee Children's Hospital, the parents were ordered to drive 2.5 hours away and take this baby to Vanderbilt, specifically for an examination by a child abuse pediatrician at Vanderbilt. Therefore, I think we have sufficiently stated that there was a policy that was the moving force behind that. I would like to, since I have a few minutes, couple minutes left, I'm going to then specifically address some things that I raised in my reply. In Vanderbilt's responsive brief, they raised other state court issues, such as the statute of repose, the Tennessee Health Care Act, which provides certain notice before a suit is provided. It requires a disclosure of an expert. I've already addressed those in my reply, but they simply do not apply to this case. And so those should just be dismissed by the court. Now, does the panel have any questions, particularly about the qualified issue related to Brent, Andrews v. Hickman County? No? Okay.
Here's, we have no questions.
Okay. All right. So are there any particular questions related to Lowen and whether or not she would qualify or that she would be able to request qualified immunity under Filarski or Richardson? No? Okay.
Any questions?
All right. Okay. I have reserved 3 minutes, so I'm going to pass this to counsel, and I'll be back to talk to you in a second.
Thank you. Mr. Cruz?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jordan Cruz. I'm with the Tennessee Attorney General's Office, and I represent the appellees Christy Duncan and Tony Scott in this appeal, and they are the two social workers for the Department of Children's Services. Plaintiff's Section 1983 claims against these defendants are directly controlled by this court's precedent, and the district court below properly applied that precedent and dismissed the claims against these defendants on two alternative bases: absolute prosecutorial immunity and qualified immunity. As to absolute immunity, both of these defendants are entitled to it because the claims against them are entirely based on the alleged actions they took in their capacities as legal advocates. And I would like to discuss Ms. Scott first. All of the allegations against Ms. Scott involved the representations or lack thereof that she made to the juvenile court in securing the removal order for CT, who is the younger child. But this court has held on multiple occasions that actions such as these, that is, making representations to the court that trigger child removal proceedings, are acts of legal advocacy that are shielded by absolute. As to Ms. Duncan, the allegations against her involve her administratively substantiating the allegations of abuse against the plaintiff mother, and also an allegation that she did not provide the juvenile court exculpatory evidence, exculpatory information regarding RBTs, the older child's medical condition. As to the administrative substantiation, when DCS performs this function, it acts in advisory role to the juvenile court, because it essentially makes recommendations as to what the juvenile court.
Why, counsel, why aren't these activities investigatory under, I think it's Achterhoff? Why aren't these investigatory activities?
In regards to what activities specifically, Your Honor, there's a couple of different things.
For example, being provided information that there could be another illness that mimics child abuse, and the request from the parents in January of 2015 that they test for that, and it was never done, and the children weren't returned till 2 years later, and it proved that this was. In a court has held that it has said that there was no abuse and exonerated the parents. Couldn't that have been done as part of the investigation in January of 2015?
Well, Your Honor, a couple of responses to that. First of all, at that point in time, the only medical opinion, expert opinion that the DCS workers had was the opinion of Dr. Lowen, who opined that this child was a victim of child abuse by the parents due to the several fractures that he had. And then secondly, the legal aspect of that, this court held in Rippey that the failure to investigate claims that the plaintiff is now alleging against Ms. Duncan do not take away absolute immunity from a social worker because the failure to investigate when they are doing that in conjunction with their duty to make recommendations to the juvenile court are acts that are protected by absolute immunity. And the court in Rippey likened it to probation officers. And probation officers have absolute immunity when they make sentencing recommendations to a criminal court. And that is why these actions are entitled to absolute immunity.
Well, then do they have no investigatory authority or job?
Do the social workers have, I'm sorry?
Yeah, these social workers, what is their You know, there's this division in the law between investigatory and acting on behalf of the court, things that are intimately associated with the judicial process. What is their responsibility to have something like this investigated?
Their responsibility under the statutes and the regulations, Your Honor, when they receive a report of child abuse, they have to investigate it. They have to get what's called a CPIT team together to determine whether or not those allegations will be substantiated. They also have to make a report and a recommendation to the juvenile court. Actually, that's their responsibility under Tennessee statute and Tennessee regulations. If I could move to,
this rather begs my question. Everybody understands that this is a really difficult setting, and it's difficult for Department of Children's Services. There's no question about that. But this was a suggestion by a parent that there was a reason for the physical problems that were found, and that reason 2 years later proved to be true. And yet it was never investigated, and both the child that was had the brittle bone syndrome and a four-day-old baby was taken away from parents based on the conclusion of child abuse that proved not to be true. I'm just trying to understand where their investigatory function works.
Well, they referred. I'm sorry. I was just going to say they did. As soon as they got the report, they referred the child to Dr. Lowen at Vanderbilt. And if I believe this is correct, looking at the plaintiff's complaint, I know that they hired their own experts to examine the medical records of the child. But I'm almost certain that that did not occur, that those experts did not render an opinion until after even the younger child was removed from the home in late 2015.
Those reports were provided in fall of 2015. That's true. But the question was raised upon which these reports opined, and the request to have it examined was in January of 15. And even if it was fall of 15, they didn't get the babies back until fall of 17. That's two more years.
That's right, Your Honor. And there is no, in the complaint, and of course we're proceeding just on the pleadings here. In the complaint, there's no reason why they did not investigate whether the child had brittle bone disease when it was requested. And I would hesitate to give you an answer that's not in the record below. Simply not.
So the basic position is they just don't have to do that. They don't have to turn over information, and they don't have to investigate.
Wouldn't the answer, counsel, be that they relied upon the child abuse expert at Vanderbilt?
Well, that's exactly right, Your Honor. They did, and that's what I was trying to say earlier, is that they immediately went to Dr. Lowen, and Dr. Lowen opined in very clear terms that this is a child of physical abuse, because the parents offered no history of trauma, no history of medical conditions, and there was literally nothing to explain the multiple fractures this infant child
had. Does the record show that they turned the request to have the brittle bones test be done and asked Dr. Lowen about that?
I'm not sure if they asked Dr. Lowen about that. I know the allegations in the complaint are that they asked Ms. Lowen to do that. I'm not sure if they asked Dr. Lowen to run those tests, but in the complaint, it does say that she asked about any medical history or family history, and that she therefore came to the conclusion that the multiple fractures were caused by non-accidental trauma, and that's why she made the diagnosis of child abuse. And I see that I'm out of time. If Your Honors have any more questions for me, I would be happy to answer those.
I think not.
Thank you.
Mr. Wiseman, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Tom Wiseman of the Tennessee Bar, and I appear today
Lori, I'm not able to see Mr. Wiseman. I'm still seeing Mr. Cruz. I think maybe Mr. White. Well, I don't know. Can't see him anyway.
Hang on one second. Marshall? Do you know if Judge Gibbons is on speaker view or gallery view?
He's on her.
Well, I think I'm now seeing Mr. Wiseman.
Okay.
My image on my own screen, though, covers up almost all of him, except I can see his face. And now I can't see him at all.
Marshall, do you mind putting your video back on? Because I think
not that's at all. Yeah, not at all.
Can you see him now, Judge Gibbons?
I can see his head.
Okay.
That's Mr. rough. Right.
Go ahead, Mr. Wiseman.
Thank you. And I'm here for Dr. Lowen in Vanderbilt University Medical Center. I think it's important to make the observation that we're here on a motion to dismiss, and the factual allegations in the complaint are the ones that we have to rely on in terms of this argument, just as Judge Richardson did in his analysis of the motions to dismiss. And what the complaint basically says is that my client, Dr. Lowen, a pediatrician employed at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, performed an examination of RBT, obtained imaging, found multiple fractures at multiple different sites with evidence of separate trauma that could not be explained by the medical and family history available at that time. So Dr. Lowen performed an exam, did an evaluation, came to a conclusion and diagnosis based upon the information at that time. The only encounter she had after that related to the issues that are before the court are that she gave a deposition some years later, I believe, about the one single encounter that Dr. Lowen had in examining this child. Now, again, looking at the complaint, which is a 1983 action, the plaintiffs have alleged that Dr. Lowen was acting as a state actor, which, of course, is a requirement for a 1983 action. And Dr. Lowen was performing in her examination a function if she is a state actor. And again, there's been no determination of that by the court below, but assuming that Dr. Lowen was a state actor, she was performing a state function and providing an opinion for the purposes of initiating child removal proceedings, assuming that her examination supported that. And therefore, her exam and her opinions were in furtherance of a state function. And we respectfully submit that under the law of the Sixth Circuit and of course, the Supreme Court, that Dr. Lowen is entitled to qualified immunity based upon the allegations of the complaint, and that the motion to dismiss was properly granted as to Dr. Lowen. Now, the two cases that were mentioned by the appellant plaintiff on argument that you just heard are the Richardson and Filarski cases. And there is no allegation in the complaint to support a Richardson-type claim. In other words, that Vanderbilt University Medical Center had an exclusive contract with the state, and that its employee, Dr. Lowen, was engaged in a private activity, like in the Richardson case, with a privately run prison, with a guard employed by the private for-profit company. And it was found in Richardson that that individual was not entitled to qualified immunity. This is a Filarski case, if I may use that term. And under the Filarski case, where the city hired an attorney who had specialized expertise to perform an investigative function on behalf of the city, the court found that that individual attorney was entitled to qualified immunity. And if the plaintiff appellant contends that Dr. Lowen was a state actor, she clearly falls within the Filarski analysis for purposes of this motion to dismiss, and she's entitled to qualified immunity. What the complaint alleges Dr. Lowen did was negligently perform an exam and withheld exculpatory evidence. Those are the two causes of action, if I may use those labels, for what the plaintiff has alleged in the many, many paragraph complaint. Those are not violations of the Fourth Amendment. There's not an arrest with criminal charges at issue here. There's not a wrongful search of a child. There's no allegation of a violation of clearly established law by Dr. Lowen. She examined a child that was before her and came to a conclusion based upon the information available to her at the time. Therefore, we submit, Your Honors, that the motion to dismiss as to Dr. Lowen was properly granted, and your de novo review of the facts alleged in the complaint or amended complaint, when compared with the applicable law, should result in this court denying this appeal. And with respect to Vanderbilt University Medical Center, taking all of the facts alleged in the complaint and considering them to be true, the Monell requirements are not alleged in this complaint that would allow a 1983 action against the institution of Vanderbilt University Medical Center under the doctrine of respondeat superior. And as a consequence, the motion to dismiss as to Vanderbilt University Medical Center is proper. There aren't allegations to support it. And we respectfully submit as to Dr. Lowen and to Vanderbilt University Medical Center, this court should rule that they should be dismissed from the case for failure to state a claim. Thank you very much.
All right, Ms. Riguli, is that correct?
So a couple things I would like to address very quickly. I want to talk a little bit about Vanderbilt, and I put this in my brief as well as in the complaint. We talked about Vanderbilt Medical Center, who received millions of dollars directly from the Department of Children's Services. They admit they actually published in an article that they had examined 2,800 cases that were diagnosed as child abuse. Dr. Lowen was their specific liaison with DCS, and they maintained clinical staffing specifically for a care team, C-A-R-E, which was to review cases. And this is not a medical review, because this is not a review where they include parents, but it's where they review with staffing whether or not a child should be diagnosed with child abuse. In addition, As to the Monell, I talk specifically about these overzealous practices of using the diagnosis of child abuse with the intent to create a legal presumption, because they are using child abuse as a medical diagnosis. But then in addition, as soon as that is presented to DCS, it becomes basically a legal presumption that a parent has to defend. And I talk about in the complaint.
What policies did you allege underlie that ongoing practice?
Yes, ma'am. So on page 49 of my brief, I said that plaintiff alleges the use of the care teams, which are without notice to the parents, the overzealous practice of using the diagnosis of child abuse with the intent of creating a legal presumption of child abuse, the receipt of millions of dollars directly from DCS, and practice of ignoring other feasible medical explanations for injuries was the moving force for the constitutional violation of the concealment of exculpatory evidence, causing children to be wrongfully removed and retained in protective custody. So I believe that we have sufficiently laid out the policies that are the driving force for Vanderbilt, and particularly Dr. Lowen, to push a child into DCS care without a thorough examination of the other medical issues. And as to other medical issues.
Ms. Riguli, could we break that down just a little bit? Where's the constitutional violation in providing overzealous medical diagnoses of child abuse? Let's assume they were. Let's assume for a second they were. They did lean towards, in disputed facts, concluding that recommending to a court that there was child abuse. Does that violate the Constitution?
Well, and Your Honor, I think specifically you have to take those two together, which is the last part of that sentence, which is the practice of ignoring other feasible medical explanations for injuries. So it would be the withholding.
All right. So how did Vanderbilt itself have a policy of ignoring other feasible explanations? Just tell Tell me how that policy manifested itself.
Well, and in particular, in this case, it was clear that even the American Academy of Pediatrics had published a consensus statement that talked about...
We're talking about the university now. We're not talking about Lowell for just a second. So let's assume that the doctor was wrong here. What is the manifestation of the university ignoring other feasible explanations? A policy that they then push down to their people to ignore other feasible explanations. Where is there evidence of that being a policy of Vanderbilt?
Well, I mean, there's evidence of it in this particular case, and this is at the Rule 12 stage. So
I got that. Let's assume that the doctor did, in fact, ignore other feasible explanations, just for purposes of this question.
Yeah.
Other than just a conclusory allegation, what is your thinking behind that being a policy of Vanderbilt?
Okay, well, I'm not exactly sure where to go with that question, respectfully, but in showing that there are other reasonable explanations for complex medical conditions of children, and they can possibly diagnose it with child abuse.
All right, let me help you out. Let me try another way. You say that this was the moving force, that Vanderbilt's policy was the moving force behind what Lowen did in this case, which yes. was conceal exculpatory evidence, right?
Yes, sir.
So how did Lowen come to know that that's what Vanderbilt was directing her to do?
Okay, thank you. Well, and I do talk in here about Lowen's position. If you look at the role that Lowen took with that university, including where I make a statement that she is, in addition, a final policymaker under the child abuse and Vanderbilt holding itself out as a tertiary center for child abuse, that she is the one who heads up the care team.
So are you saying that Vanderbilt had a policy? Are you saying that Lowen had a policy and she was a final decision maker and thereby her policy was Vanderbilt's? Is that your argument?
Yes, sir.
Is that it? Is that the whole theory here?
Well, that was the policy of the driving force for the constitutional violation. And there are several things. One is that Vanderbilt holds
itself. Did Vanderbilt do anything here to encourage Lowen to do what she did, other than vest her with what you contend to be final policy-making authority for the university?
Well, as I explained in the complaint, through publications, Vanderbilt specifically holds itself out as a tertiary center for child abuse. They publish of how they have these care teams.
So they're a tertiary center and they have care teams. So therefore that means all their doctors should conceal exculpatory evidence. I mean, I don't even get the basic logic behind this.
I mean, as to their integral role with the whole child abuse investigation, and particularly in this case, these parents were ordered to go to Vanderbilt as opposed to where the child had previously received care.
They weren't ordered to go there by Vanderbilt. They were ordered to go there by right. the state.
Right. That is correct. And part of my allegations are that that Lowen and Duncan, I mean, particularly Duncan and Scott, and that they were all acting in concert for this to occur, that these children were wrongfully removed and retained because of their concerted actions. Duncan and Scott could not have done it alone, and they took it to Vanderbilt so that Lowen, who acted in an investigatory capacity, separated the parents, interviewed them.
You're way beyond my question, so thank you for trying.
Thank you.
Your time's up. We appreciate the arguments that all of you've given. We'll consider the case very carefully.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you.